previously on Beta.
Who are you?
Marco Ruiz, Chihuahua State Police. Who are you?
Sonia Cross, El Paso Homicide.
So began the legend of Pai Mei's five-point palm exploding heart technique.
So Harriet Tubman is like on the Cumbie River and she was like, I'm down for this, like I'm ready.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Wisconsin's very own Mike Moe tells us what it was like to play one of his personal heroes, Bruce Lee, in the Quentin Tarantino movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
There have been a few opportunities where I was very close to playing Bruce, but for whatever reason, some of those things didn't go my way. To have it all come together in a project like this with a maestro director like Quentin Tarantino has been worth the wait.
Mike will join us a little later. And author Jennifer Wright on her book, We Came First, which features historical women offering relationship advice.
Some of the women that were the most fun to write were women who were giving advice that I did not think I would give. I have no desire to murder my mother-in-law like Marguerite de Valois.
That must come as quite a relief to Jennifer's mother-in-law. But first, we explore the big stories from Little America. The anthology series is one of the first offerings from the Apple TV Plus streaming service. Each episode of Little America gives us an intimate look at a different immigrant's experience here in the United States. Josh Behrman is an executive producer for the series. He's also a reporter and the co-founder of the website Epic Magazine. Epic Magazine reported the initial series of stories that served as the inspiration for the TV show.
The idea originally was, let's just tell immigrant stories as regular stories. And Lee Eisenberg is a well-known writer and showrunner in film and TV. And I know him socially, and he came to me. This was just after the election. I think it was around the inauguration, actually, and said he was interested in developing something around immigrants. His father's an immigrant, and he'd been thinking about their relationships to America and how they differ from one another. And then, of course, the election happened, and so I think it really was around the inauguration. It's like the reality of the new political era was setting in, and that's when he called and he said, "Do you want to do something like this?" And I said, "Sure." That seemed like a very valuable use of, you know, our storytelling abilities. So I sent a lot of researchers and writers and went out and collected as many different stories as we could. I mean, it was very time consuming. As you know, we probably started with 100 plus leads and then did maybe like 75 interviews or something and then narrowed it down from there to 40 or so people that we really talked to a lot. And then eventually we published 15 stories when we kind of polished it all up and down to a core group. And we had stories from Idaho and Kansas and Florida and Ohio and all these different places, Texas. And even as they were kind of coming together, we were getting a sense of, oh, the shape of this show is going to work as an anthology where you can kind of each story is a different facet, right? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of this mosaic portrait. So we wanted stories that were widely representative, people from different parts of the world living in different parts of the country, people who were here as refugees or to study, you know, in school.
Good afternoon, Professor Robbins. I filled my TA application weeks ago. When do we hear?
The application window hasn't closed yet.
I see. Well, to refresh your memory, I'm the best in class. I have the most need and the money we're helping to get back home this summer.
I'm trying to hire a student who can teach in my stead.
That is me.
You're also extremely pushy.
How am I pushy?
Well, take, for example, how you're going about trying to get this job. The truth is, you make people a little uncomfortable. And for someone who wants to join the faculty, you don't seem to try very hard to fit in. Now, if you'll excuse me.
People who have just been arrived or people who have been here for, you know, decades, people who succeeded here and people who maybe didn't succeed to the desire they thought. And so as the producers and writers are looking at them, we were able to see the half hour of television more clearly and see what the adaptation possibilities are. And so they kind of just sort of emerged out of the 15 as the subgroup somewhat naturally.
Yeah. And given the subject matter of these stories, the stories in Little America, they naturally come up against U.S. immigration policies, which are very controversial these days. How did these policies influence the way you adapted these real stories into episodes?
Well, emotionally and story-wise, you know, the current American politics did not really influence explicitly what we were doing because none of the episodes are sort of taking on immigration directly. They are indirectly. They're not meant to be overtly political, but they're political by virtue of just sort of telling stories from the lives of immigrants and portraying them as people with the same struggles as everybody else, and trying to sort of break the notion of a narrative where there, you know, there's an othering of people coming from somewhere or a simplification of, you know, all immigrants are refugees. So there was kind of a subtextual politics there, but didn't tackle immigration directly other than to sort of make the general humanist kind of obvious point of everybody's the same. When people come here, they have the same, you know, hopes and dreams or fears and frailties that we do. And there's no they or we anyhow, really. So that said, there was actually a production issue relating to current immigration law, which was kind of a supreme irony, which is we have an episode that is about a Syrian guy who's gay, discovered he was gay when he was young, was caught by his family with a man, and in that part of the world, that can be very dangerous. His family actually was maybe trying to kill him, definitely inflicting bodily harm on him, so he fled. And he eventually gets to Jordan, and then he winds up, and he applies for asylum in the United States, and he gets to Idaho. And there he is sort of finally able to be who he wants to be.
Girl, you look like you just fled your homeland. Take a shower, come on, we're going out.
The end of the episode is sort of the end of the original story as he told it also, where it's kind of his flight. It's one of the stories that's actually sort of the story, the big kind of like immigration story of how I got here. Most of them are not like that. But his winds up with him going into his first gay bar and seeing the sort of expression of sexual identity unfettered, and he can't believe it. And then he actually met the guy that he is now married to. And so that's, you know, a very emotional and sort of inspiring story and says some very nice things about what America represents. However, currently, the travel ban makes it so that somebody from Syria cannot come here and many other countries. And so a lot of the actors that we wanted to use for the episode don't live in the United States. They're in London or other places, Canada. And so they couldn't come into the country. And so here we are telling a story about how America, like, you know, opens its doors, lets people who have to flee for their lives so they can be themselves. And we couldn't actually shoot that episode in America anymore. We had to move production to Canada. We shot it in Montreal.
Which episode was this?
That episode is called The Sun. Mm-hmm. It's number 8. It's the final episode. It's sort of the capper of the series.
Yeah, that's interesting, the lengths you had to go to and how that provided a real kind of editorial comment on the situation.
Yeah, it was not lost on everybody putting this production together. And we thought, oh, this is all the more reason to make the show.
The first episode is called The Manager. Can you tell us a bit about this episode?
Sure. And this is sort of a melancholy story, which is this boy, Kabir, in the episode Kunal in real life. His family's from India, and they run a small motel together. And the parents have to go back to India to deal with visa immigration stuff. And it's one of those things where they're, we got to go back to do the paperwork. But then the paperwork took 10 years.
It's a bureaucratic issue.
But it's your fault this happened. You lack prospicience. That means foresight.
And these things take time.
So he was left there to run the hotel at, you know, 13 years old. So he's like this kind of, and he's a precocious kid who's very smart. He was like competed in the state and national spelling bee. So he's this kid with real promise, and he's going to school and also the manager of this motel.
I run an economy value in Alfred 22. We're the third ranked motel in Green River, according to TripAdvisor, and I like to keep it that way. I don't have time for spelling bees.
But then it becomes a little bit of a different story when you see him age over time and you realize as a teenager that because his parents were gone and he had to be an adult for himself, he didn't get to have the childhood and the teenage years and the youth that he had hoped for. And so it's a sad moment when you see him realize that. And this is true to life. And so, and then his parents eventually do come back. And of course, he's thrilled. But then there's the weird reality that they haven't been together in all this time. And so he hasn't grown up with them. So they don't know each other anymore. Right. So there's this melancholy moment at the end where they realize like they don't know how to relate to each other.
Yeah. It's a very powerful episode. And as you mentioned, the parents are away. They're back in India. It takes 10 years to get the paperwork accepted so that they can return to the States. Do you have a favorite scene in this episode?
I feel like the very, very end is just among the most powerful moments in all of the series, because the emotional complexity is coming through there and it's not really what you expect, where they're together, but they don't really know how to be together anymore. And he feels better, but is aware of the loss. And the parents are glad to be home, but know that something has changed.
Beta, how's your life? You have a good life?
It's fine.
But you can tell by the way he says it and just the whole facial expression that he's not fully happy, and he shouldn't be, because as you said, he exhibited a lot of promise. He was spelling bees, and there's this great storyline at the beginning about how his dad says if he can memorize all the words in Webster's dictionary by the time he's 16, he'll get a Trans Am. So it's very nuanced and a very powerful episode. What kind of feedback have you received from people after they've seen the episode based on their personal life story about the way they were portrayed? What kinds of things do they say?
In general, people have really responded. I mean, this original subjects who have seen the episodes. And in a couple cases, we've been there together when they were first screened.
Oh, that must be an interesting experience.
Yes. So I watched one of the episodes with, which is the episode is called Marisol, which is, I think, number 2.
Yes.
And the subject's name is Reina originally. And so we kind of got a screening together and watched it. She had her fiance there. It was kind of delightful to watch her watching it. She was sort of freaked out at first, like, oh, I'm going to hide my face and be embarrassed mostly, right? You know?
Yeah.
And she was instead delighted. She had a big smile on her face. And then afterwards, she was sort of stunned for a little bit and trying to process it and was overwhelmed. And then, you know, and then sort of the dam broke and she talked about how much she loved it and just how valuable she thought it was. Mm. And so that was very gratifying to see.
Yeah, that's the second episode, The Jaguar, right? In which she becomes becomes really good at squash and becomes like a champion, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I think these stories would still work as fiction, but it seems like that they're more powerful and more effective because they're based on true stories. What do you think?
I do think that. I find that to be the case with the projects that we work on in general. I also, one of my stories was adapted into the film Argo.
Yeah.
And I think often, in some way, you get more liberty as a storyteller in adaptation when it's coming from a true story, because if you invented the story of Argo, for example, then it would have seemed ridiculous. Oh, they used a movie and fake science fiction movie to smuggle out diplomats. You'd be like, no, I'm not buying it, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, same with some of these episodes. Like, you know, it's a pretty dramatic story, shoddy story. Or even Reina's story. An undocumented kid becomes a squash champion and then now is an analyst at Goldman Sachs, you know, based on the fact that she got her life together and got purpose from squash, and the eccentric squash coach who's sort of a weirdo but guides her. Like, those things would read as false, right?
Yeah.
If they were invented. But because they're real, you can connect to them in a different way.
Good. Very good.
Really?
No, you were bad. But inside of you, there is a jaguar.
Okay.
In the words of the great basketball player, Kevin Garnett, a.k.a. KG, you cannot teach the beast. It is either in you or it is not. You cannot go to the store and buy a six-pack of beast.
I wonder, it would be interesting to do an experiment if psychologists if have done this. If you didn't know that it was a true story, would it still have that same impact on you? Or is there something about the way our brains are wired and empathy and things that because we know it's true that we're more invested in it? I wonder.
That is a really good question. Very interesting potential psychological study. I wonder, because like I think about the human storytelling antenna, you know, in relationship to true stories and fictionalized stories all the time, and I hadn't quite thought of it that way. I would love to see somebody get to the bottom of that.
Yeah, I'll have to look into that and find out if anyone has. But you mentioned Argo, and when you were working on this story, did you ever think it would end up on the big screen and become the big film that it was, 2012 film
came out
with Affleck, and didn't it win Best Picture that year?
It did. It won Best Picture. won the Globes. It won the BAFTAs. It won all the Guild Awards. It was sort of astonishing. No, I did not expect that.
So you
thought it's pretty good. It'll be, you know, like they know what they're doing. And, you know, it came out and sort of right out of the gate felt like something different. It feels a little bit similar here where it's very hard to get anything actually made, much less make it good. I was like, this is pretty good. People will like it. But the reception has been much greater than I imagined and the full-throated enthusiasm. And it feels like, oh, there's something special going on here in a way that we hadn't even anticipated.
Yeah. If you don't mind my asking, did you get an Oscar yourself?
I did not get there. No, there is no Oscar for
being
best
the source material. Well, we got to change that.
I know. Yeah. I know.
And retroactively.
Chris Terrio, the writer, screenwriter who adapted it, did get an Oscar for best adapted screenplay. But I don't get one, unfortunately. Even though my name is on his Oscar, because it says like best, you know, it's like
it's on his
for Argo based on the story by blah blah. It's like a very elaborate credit that like was read, you know, at the Oscars on stage, which was sort of to the delight of my parents. But no, I did not get my own statue.
Mm. Well, there's still time though.
Yeah.
Little America has already been renewed for a second season. Is there anything that you'd like to do differently during the second season in terms of the kind of storytelling?
Yes, I think we are. I mean, where the writer's room is ongoing right now. In fact, I stepped out in order to come and sit down with you. And many of the writers from last season are back and some new ones, and everybody's sitting around looking at all the collection of stories that we have to figure out what's in season two. And I think what's been interesting to us is, you know, we have a pretty good range of stories in the first season, and there's some tonal range too, you know, and just like the directorial tone of the episodes varying, you know, from one to the other. But I think we might even try to stake out more territory and experiment a little bit more in a couple places. You know, widen the range a little bit so that it's not just sort of eight more really good episodes like last time. They're taking sort of different risks.
Josh Behrman is one of the executive producers of Little America, which streams on Apple TV+. Find out more about Josh and the show at wpr.org/beta.
I think the greatest gift that Quentin gave me that week was he just let me be. A couple of rehearsals before we started shooting, he said, look, it's all on you.
Mike Moe tells us about his journey from Wanakee, Wisconsin to Hollywood, California to portray the iconic actor and martial artist Bruce Lee in the Quentin Tarantino movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. His story is coming up next. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Quentin Tarantino's Oscar-nominated film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is the filmmaker's love letter to Tinseltown. His recreation of 1969 Los Angeles features fictional characters colliding with real-life actor Sharon Tate and director Roman Polanski. And one of the scene stealers in the movie is legendary martial artist and actor Bruce Lee. Lee is played by Wisconsin's Mike Moe. He's the founder of Moe's Martial Arts in Wanakee, but also spends time in L.A. acting in film and TV. Mike joins us now to tell his story of the journey from Wanakee to the Academy Awards, where he got a shout-out from his co-star and Best Supporting Actor winner, Brad Pitt.
And the Oscar goes to Brad Pitt. Once upon a time.
And to the rest of the cast and crew, Big Bad Bob Richardson, Robert Garcia, Richie, my man Mike Moe.
So how did you get the part of Bruce Lee in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Funny, I was actually teaching at my martial arts studio. There's a little plug, Wanakee, Wisconsin. Yeah. It was martial arts. I was teaching a class, and my Apple Watch goes off. It's my agent. I run quick. I take the call, and they say, hey, you need to be on a flight to Los Angeles tonight.
Wow.
Because Quentin Tarantino is doing a new movie, and Bruce Lee is in it. So immediately, I had my classes covered, and I went home, packed it up, booked a flight, and then the next day, I was given this very covert and secret manila envelope, which had the scene of the movie with Bruce Lee, and they wouldn't let me take it home, so I had to study it, and then the next day, I did the audition, and I went home. So I didn't hear anything for maybe a week. And then I got a call from my agent, said, Quentin watched your tape, and he responded to it.
Wow.
And he wants to meet you.
Right. If you don't mind my asking, can you talk a bit about what you guys talked about during that first meeting?
Before I did my audition, we just sat and talked about movies. We sat and talked about our mutual love for Bruce Lee and just specific movies and specific tones and moments in Bruce Lee movies. And not only that, but he was just sharing... He knows more about kung fu movies than I do, you know.
Because I guess he knows more about movies in general.
Yeah,
really?
Shaw Brothers. You know,
were you surprised that he knew more that much about kung fu movies?
Yeah, actually, I was very, very surprised. Like, you know, he's probably the world's foremost movie fan, and he knows everything. And even on set, like, he would reference the most obscure things and the most little-known actors, and to him, this is just his playground. So.
Right. And then they're so obscure that you probably don't get the references, right?
Absolutely.
And then do you admit that, or do you just play along?
Nod my head, and I'm just like, yes, sir, yep, I got it.
So I understand that there was a table read. That was kind of the next step in the process, right? Mm-hmm. What was that like?
Yeah, so meeting Quentin, that was probably stage two. Mm-hmm. And then I did my audition with him. That went great, and... came home. I didn't hear anything for 2 weeks. So that was quite a long 2 weeks in my life. And I kept hearing from my agent, yeah, you're still in the mix. You know, the next time you go in, it's probably going to be you. And actually, Quentin told me at the end of my audition with him, he said, the next time I see you, it'll be you and two or three other Bruces vying for the role.
Oh.
So he made it seem like it was going to be some sort of battle royale.
Yeah, like a Bruce off or something.
Exactly.
Like Bruce Lee off, yeah.
So I just immediately looked him in the eye and said, hey, I just want to let you know I'm the right guy for the part.
Mm.
And so, you know, trying to bring in some of that Bruce confidence, you know, in person.
He probably liked that, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And then when I finally got the call, they said, yeah, you're going to be doing a chemistry read. And after that, the next day, the stunt team wants to meet you to see if you can actually move. So I was feeling pretty confident about the stunt team thing. But as far as the chemistry read, I was thinking, oh, boy, I'm going to have to meet Brad and
meet with him to see if
this scene works between the two of us. And I got the directions. I flew into town. I pull up to the address, but it's this black gated studio or small house on Sunset Boulevard. And I was the first one of the first people there. I walk in, the first person to open the door is Quentin greeting me. Hey, Mike, let me introduce you to my friend, Burt. And I look past him, and there's Burt Reynolds.
Wow.
Who had been cast in the film, who unfortunately, sadly, passed before he could do the role.
Mm. So what part was he supposed to play?
He was supposed to play George Spann.
Oh, okay, right. You know, Bruce Dern, the part Bruce Dern
exactly.
played. Right,
so
okay.
I got to meet, you know, there. It's like, wow, starstruck already. And then I settle into this room, this long table with a bunch of placards and a bunch of people hanging around, producers, and I see Dakota Fanning, I see Emile Hirsch, I see Luke Perry, who, you know, again, he was right to my left, so it was, you know, incredible that I got to meet him before he passed as well. But just all these people that I had no idea were involved in the film, because at the time, all the research and all the articles said Leo, Brad, and Margot.
Yeah.
Everybody else was actually announced later that afternoon.
Mm.
So I kind of got to see it all before it was public information, and I think I was the only person at that table read that had not been officially offered the role.
Mm.
So Quentin later told me, he said, yeah, I wanted to bring you in to see how you would react.
Yeah. How did you feel you did at the table read?
I guess just good enough to get the role, but I feel like I knew it was my final test.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that I would perform well with the stunt team, and if I could get through this and really impress everybody, that I it would be going my way. So, mm-hmm. you know, I just keep remembering, because the only information that I got for auditioning was our main scene that I did with Brad in the movie. So I furiously paged through this whole script, which was, you know, 3-4 inches thick, and I'm looking for my scene because I knew that I'd have to read this with Brad in front of everybody.
Yeah.
So I furiously paged through the pages until I found the scene. It was page 53. I'll never forget it. And every page that was read by all those actors across the table from me got me one page closer
yeah.
to when I was going to have my moment.
So how were you feeling as you were getting pages closer as you hit page 47, 48? Were you nervous?
Yeah, I wish I would have had a heart rate monitor.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure it just kept steadily spiking up. But I just remember saying, like, hey, I'm going to go big. I'm not going to be the guy that plays it safe and just kind of goes along with it. Because a lot of those actors are very established, and they would just read it as if they were just talking. Just as a casual read, but I made sure that I was full on Bruce mode, full on performing, and Brad and I actually started getting into it.
Oh, cool. You know,
like eye contact and just like this fun banter, and everybody at the table was laughing.
You're a little man with a big mouth and a big chip, and I think you should be embarrassed to suggest you'd be anything more than a stain on the seat of Cassius Clay's trunks.
Father, you're the one with the big mouth. And I would really enjoy closing it, especially in front of all my friends. But my hands are registered as lethal weapons. That means we get into a fight, I accidentally kill you, I go to jail.
Anybody accidentally kills anybody in a fight, they go to jail. It's called manslaughter.
Yeah, so how and when did you find out that you officially, that you had got the role?
I think after the table read, I think it was still a good 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So I just remember I was in Wanakee at our little neighborhood pool, and it was summer. So I'm swimming in the pool with my kids, and I get my call, and I get the news, and I freak out a little bit. I'm sure some of my neighbors were wondering
what I was going so giddy on about. Over there.
I do a big belly flop into the pool to celebrate, and it was a good day.
Yeah, a great day. Yeah. So as you mentioned, Bruce Lee is someone that both you and Quentin Tarantino have mutual love for. Can you tell me a bit about what Bruce Lee means to you?
Yeah, I mean, he, along with, so the three guys that I saw that I really, you know, used as trailblazers for my own life, because I didn't really see a lot of Asian male faces on screen. And my dad and I would watch these movies all the time. The first one is Jackie and Bruce, and then later on it was Jet Li, and now it's like Donnie Yen. So as far as Asian male representation, that's what I knew. And because I was into martial arts already, that was something that was like really got my blood boiling to see those guys kicking so much butt on the screen.
Yeah.
And to be able to play Bruce has been kind of a lifelong bucket list thing for me ever since I started acting. And there have been a few opportunities where I was very close to playing Bruce, but for whatever reason, some of those things didn't go my way. So to have it all come together in a project like this with a maestro director like Quentin Tarantino has been worth the wait.
Yeah, yeah. So what did you do to prepare for playing Bruce Lee?
First, I rewatched all of his movies, which wasn't too difficult to do. And I think the biggest thing is, you know, the movie is 2 hours and 40-some minutes, and Bruce is in three scenes, and he's only really in one long extended scene where he speaks. So I had to make sure that with the little time that I had, that it was a memorable and impactful scene.
And it sure was.
Number one, I need people to know more, you know, just beyond the look, that they could feel Bruce and his spirit, you know. Obviously, fictional liberties were taken in the film, but as far as his energy and as far as his presence and his attitude, that's what I really wanted to capture. So the one thing that I really relied on was the interview he did with Pierre Bertrand.
Ah, my fellow Canadian.
The black and white interview.
Right,
one of the only ones that is videoed, that has a video and also a long form interview.
Yeah.
So that was where you could also get a sense of just who he was as opposed to just philosopher Bruce Lee. Mm. But he had a good mix of, you know, he would say, be water, but also he would share his opinions on different things and just his attitudes. And when you watch the video, you would notice certain mannerisms he would have with his hands or with his body, or how he would physicalize a lot of his phrases, kind of like he does in martial arts. So he uses all of his being to accentuate a point. Mm-hmm. So that was something that I didn't really take specific movements, but I think as I watched that every single day, as I had it in my earphones, it just started to become more natural. And I even started to take some of those physical traits and into my own martial arts teaching. So I'm sure some of the students at my martial arts school, they noticed my hair getting longer. They noticed my cadence and my voice changing a little. And whether that was on purpose or not, it helped in my transformation to help that, to play that part.
What was the best bit of direction you got from Quentin Tarantino during the shoot?
I've heard so many stories about how he is on set before. I studied everything. I just I didn't want to be caught off guard. And I've read both things, that he can be very, very, very controlling and very intense, and that he could be very fun and loose and relaxed. But I think he knows exactly what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Every single one of his films is literally like a child to him.
Yeah.
And there's nobody on the set that cares more than him about that movie. And I think that's why it's very impressive that he brings many of the same people back on the crew, because he knows that he can trust these people that also have that equal passion, whether it be in costuming or set design or camera work. So I think that's very admirable that Quentin can rally the troops the way he does and create an environment on set that everybody is laser focused. So a lot of times in movies, he gets the best performance out of the actors. And for me, like, I've never felt more of an actor than on his set. So him being on set, I'll use our example of Brad and my scene, our extended scene. Yeah. We had a full, I can't remember how much, it was over 4 minutes. We had a non-cutaway, it was a one
shot. Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, I timed it. I think it was pretty much exactly 4 minutes, that 4 minutes of one continuous shot without an edit, in which you and Brad's character are jaw-jacking at one another before you kick him in the chest.
Yeah.
Yeah, so how tough was it to shoot that, like, uninterrupted, no edit, 4 minute scene?
I think the greatest thing, gift that Quentin gave me that week was he just let me be. He didn't really, when we were on set, he let me be. You know, a couple of rehearsals before we started shooting, he said, "Look, it's all on you," because I have an idea of how I want to shoot this scene. Yeah. It's going to be a one shot take. This is how I want to do it, and if you don't nail it, I'm going to have to change it. And this is the way I want to shoot it. But I wouldn't have hired you if I didn't believe that you could do it.
Yeah.
So as my knees are quivering, I say, "Yes, yes, sir. You got the right guy."
Yeah. How many takes did it take to
get
it?
So I think, if I remember correctly, he gave us like a pep talk. He said, "All right, we've got this long 4.5 minute scene. There's definitely going to be multiple takes, because there's going to be a plane that flies by, or somebody's going to flub a line, or the camera's going to be out of position. And if there's any moment where I don't like it, don't assume it's you. I'm just going to cut it so we can save our performance, because it might be a long day." I don't know how many days they had blocked off for this, but I know it was a lot more than what we actually had to use it in, because I think we got it in our fourth take.
Oh, way to go. Yeah, that's very impressive.
I just remember he said, "Don't freak out as we get close to the end, because there's going to be this tendency to start celebrating before you finish the scene. Stay in it."
Yeah, stay in the
moment.
And
then when I say cut, then we get it. And so we got it on the fourth take, and I think Quentin was already jumping up and down. So he was kind of contradicting himself. You can see him off to the side. Yeah. Not only he's the one that's laughing the loudest at the jokes.
Yeah.
He's the one just, I don't know if you can't see me, obviously, but he's fidgeting.
You're
just
gesticulating.
Jumping around.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then we call cut, and he's the first one jumping up and down, and we all celebrate, Brad and I, high 10, it was a celebration. He's like, "That's the one that's going to be in the movie, but we're going to do it again." And then he says, "Why?" And then the whole crew, unbeknownst to me, says, "Because we love making movies." Mm. And it was this whole team thing.
That's great.
And it just felt like that moment I was like welcomed into this Tarantino film family. And then we did it again. And they called that the little sister. I think it took us two or three more times to get another good one that he was happy with. But I think the one that he used in the film was that first one.
Wow. That's a great moment that you experienced there. Yeah. There's a bit of controversy surrounding your character. And to be clear, it doesn't have anything to do with your portrayal. But Bruce Lee's daughter, Shannon Lee, has said that Quentin Tarantino seemed to have gone out of his way to make fun of her father and to portray him as a buffoon. What do you think of that comment?
I'm not sure about the con- No, just kidding. Yeah, you know, I can understand her position. That's her father, and you know, I'm not in a position to say anybody's right or wrong. I'm as big of a Bruce Lee fan as there is, and I think he kind of had to be.
Oh, yeah.
A little, for you sure. know. There's a very thin line between being cocky and being very confident. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he was on Green Hornet, but yes. even though he was on a show that was on ABC primetime, he was still second fiddle. He was still forced to wear the mask a lot of the time. So even though he was kind of on his way to superstardom, he never got to experience how famous he became.
Yeah.
So he was still fighting his way, trying to change the perception of what an Asian man is on screen, representation-wise. So he had to be a little cocky and a little boastful. And that's what was so important to me, to like see that, oh, an Asian man doesn't have to be subservient or weak. He can be strong and confident and have a little attitude towards him. And I think that's what a lot of people around the world really gravitate to as far as Bruce Lee's concerned.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. I think you're absolutely right. What is your dream role?
Dream role? Well,
yeah.
Man, it's I keep saying I'm kind of over it now, but after the premiere and after the movie came out, I was kind of like, I felt like I was creatively hungover a little bit because I had just come off my dream role. So now I'm just trying to figure out what is it that I really, really want to do. Obviously, I got into this business to kick butt in movies.
Yeah.
You know, but now I've got a new belief in myself that I don't have to just do the action roles.
No.
I can do the drama roles. I could do comedy roles.
Yeah.
I could do different things. But at the end of the day, like, if you were to tell me, you know, here's this amazing action script, or here's a chance to work with Keanu Reeves in a John Wick film, like that would get my blood boiling.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, variety is the spice of life, and I'm excited at all the opportunities that may or may never come. And that's exciting too, not knowing exactly what's next.
Yeah. Mike Mo, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Appreciate it.
Mike Mo's an actor and a martial arts instructor in Wisconsin. He plays Bruce Lee in the Quentin Tarantino film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Find out more about Mike and his story at WPR.org/beta. Coming up next, we get relationship advice from historical women, courtesy of author Jennifer Wright. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The women of the past were anything but the doting caricatures they're often made out to be. They were under a lot of the same pressures when it came to dating and mating as modern women, and many of their solutions would be considered progressive, even by today's standards. Your lackluster boyfriend, your mixed feelings about children, whether or not to host a massive orgy, they would have been able to advise you on all of that. Whether you'd have liked what they had to say is an entirely different matter.
That's Jennifer Wright reading an excerpt from her book, We Came First, Relationship Advice from Women Who Have Been There. It's the fourth in a series of pop history books that Jennifer has written highlighting women. Jennifer joined us to explain how she transformed a personal passion for history into these informative, irreverent books.
I used to run a women's website called The Gloss,
and
it was about fashion and beauty, and I started doing this column called Shelf Dolls. It was all about famously fashionable women from the past who people might not remember very well. And I was shocked that it immediately took off, that it very, very quickly became the most popular feature on our site.
Oh, wow.
And I really didn't expect that. I didn't realize there was such a hunger on people's part to learn more about these women who had existed 50 or 100 or 200 years ago. And once I realized that, I started talking to agents about how we could develop the idea into a book.
And at first, I think I just said, like, these are some women I like. Can I write about them? And they said, no, you need to figure out a topic. So I tried to think about the topics that would allow people to relate to these women or these situations even more. Mm. And I hope this book is one where we do that really well.
Can you talk a bit about the premise behind We Came First?
The premise is that it's written in a Dear Abby style, where somebody writes to a woman of the past asking for advice on something going on with their life. And then based on how that woman responded to events in her life, or hopefully letters that we have from her, she writes back with advice on what she did in a similar situation.
How did you come up with this idea?
My husband refers to all the historical figures that I study as being my ghost friends.
Huh.
And I turn to their experiences a lot personally for advice. It's nice to see how people I admired, or at least people I'm very interested in, sometimes people who I desperately don't want to end up like, responded to different situations in the past.
You also had to create fictional questions for each of these women of history to answer. How were you able to match the tone of the questions to the women giving the advice?
Well, I think we knew the women first. We knew mm-hmm. the women first, and I kind of had a vague idea of, okay, well, Empress Josephine went through a pretty big divorce. We should put her into the divorce section and then work backwards a little bit from there, depending upon how she felt about it. Mm-hmm. So I think it was about half and half. I think starting out, I knew there were some questions that I would definitely want to ask. I knew I wanted to work in maybe someone who had ambivalent feelings about motherhood, which is something that I think the media has talked a lot more about in the past 5 years, and I think that's really interesting. So I definitely wanted to get someone from the past on that. But it really was a mix. It really depended on – there were also situations where I would be reading about some figure, and then there would be a note of there's another figure who had a similar situation. And then I would jump over there and realize, oh, my gosh, this woman is just so interesting. We have to put her in.
Mm. Yeah. Which part was more fun for you, creating the questions or the answers?
Well, creating the answers is definitely easier because other people did all the work in their lives. Creating the answers and trying to come up with the right tone that I thought women would actually speak in. Obviously, Pope Joan's tone is going to be very different than Marilyn Monroe's tone.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Thinking about that was very fun for me. And really, some of the women that were the most fun to write were women who were giving advice that I did not think I would give. Mm. I have no desire to murder my mother-in-law like Marguerite de Valois, but I'm glad somebody went for it.
Yeah, and I'm sure your mother-in-law is glad that you have no desire to murder her.
We're all collectively glad
yeah.
I don't want to murder my mother-in-law. Yeah.
One of the great things about your book is that the advice that these women of the past give isn't necessarily good advice. Why did you take this approach?
Well, I don't think all people give good advice.
That's true.
Think that there are probably, you know, if you're having trouble with the members of the opposite sex, you shouldn't go to your friend who got divorced 2 days ago and maybe is not feeling so great about them.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to encapsulate the fact that some of these people give advice that I think is very questionable. And I hope I make it clear that nobody should go out and murder their mother-in-law. I think you'll go to jail. But I did want to capture a wide range of advice, and different people have different experiences.
Do you have a favorite example of the bad advice that one of these women in We Came First gives?
Oh, you know, I Nell Gwynn, dealing mm-hmm. with a competition.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Nell, I'm in a real predicament. I have a crush on a man who seems great, but he already has a girlfriend. I would really, really feel that he and I would be a better match, but trying to steal him away from his current partner feels tacky and immoral. But then, can you really steal someone? Are there circumstances under which it would be okay to pursue him? I guess I'm just conflicted. Dear conflicted, poison her food. Don't kill her. Lace it with laxatives before they go out on their next date. That's what I did to Charles's mistress, Moll Davis.
I invited her to a lunch fortified with laxatives. She spent the night on the chamber pot rather than in the king's bed. And then I swooped in like the kind of sexy angel who poisons people. Was it wrong? Is all fair in love and war? I don't know, but I think a thorough cleanse is fine. And besides, you can't steal a man. He's not a flower pot. You must only look for ways to make yourself more appealing. Besides, my plan worked out great. I remained the king's mistress for 17 years, and my boys were given royal titles. People are still writing books and making movies about me. No one remembers to include that laxative incident, though.
Don't
poison your rival's food.
No, not good.
But I did think that it was a very sassy, very Nell Gwynn type move. Mm-hmm. She was known as Pretty Witty Nell. And she did a lot of very funny, very brazen things in her life.
Mm-hmm. That is so Nell, isn't it?
It's so Nell.
Yeah. Which one of the women you profile in your book has the best advice for women today?
Oh, gosh. I think that's impossible to say because I think it entirely depends on what you're going through. I personally love being married. I love what it represents. But if you really feel pressured into that and it's not an institution that's for you, you might find comfort in Simone de Beauvoir's advice about how marriage can be very detrimental for both parties and how it's not something that works out well. Or Queen Elizabeth or Coco Chanel, who talk about how their careers became much stronger because they chose to remain unmarried. Mm-hmm. Or you might, again, I am also monogamous. I really am so square compared to any of these women. But you might enjoy reading about Victoria Gordon Woodhouse, who had four husbands, or Lucrezia Borgia, who was organizing orgies. I think it depends entirely on where you're at in your life and the advice that you are receptive to receiving.
Yeah, yeah. Very well said. You've been married for about 2.5 years now, and you have this whole section on marriage. This section features Queen Victoria's advice on motherhood and Frida Kahlo's advice on having your own space, which she literally did. Have you drawn on any of the advice in this section for your own marriage?
I mean, this is embarrassing. I have a very, very happy marriage.
Why is that embarrassing?
It's so uninteresting. My husband and I want to be around each other all the time. So
nice.
I read him Frida Kahlo's advice, and we were both horrified by this notion that you would live in a separate dwelling from your partner. How would you hug? What if you find an interesting fact and you need to tell the other person immediately?
Yeah.
So I couldn't imagine doing that, but I also have friends who are bi-coastal and live separately from their partners, and it's wonderful for them.
You mentioned your husband. He's Daniel Kibblesmith. He's a staff writer for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. If you don't mind my asking, what does Daniel think of your book?
Daniel is a ridiculously big supporter of everything I am doing, so I am certain he is alerting all of our friends to this interview right now as it's happening. I feel like it's probably a little easier for him to enjoy stories about interesting historical women like this.
Mm-hmm.
But every day when he comes home, usually the first words out of my mouth are, guess what I found out about Josephine Baker today? You're not going to believe this.
Mm.
So, yeah, my research and my reading is a big part of our relationship.
Yeah.
It was probably less pleasant when I was writing about historical plagues. And we would be having dinner and I'd be like, yeah, do you want to know how the pus for? Would that be that fun dinner conversation?
Yeah. What's next for you? Another pop history book?
I have another book coming out next year. This one is called Slay, Women Who Killed. So it's about female assassins and poisoners throughout history.
Ooh.
And I wanted to write it because as a woman, I feel scared so often in such a real way. Anytime I'm walking by myself when it's dark,
I was interested in what it would be like to be a woman who actually makes it a scary time for men and what it's like for what it was like for female assassins to exist. What would it be like to be this person who nobody is really scared of, who also has the ability to kill? And it's been fascinating to read about.
Mm-hmm. So we'll see Lizzie Borden in there, I'm
You
guessing.
Will definitely see Lizzie Borden. And by the way, she did it. I know there's controversy. She definitely did it.
Yeah, yeah. Looking forward to that. Jennifer Wright, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Wright is the author of We Came First, Relationship Advice from Women Who Have Been There. Find out more about Jennifer at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Josh Behrman, Mike Moe, and Jennifer Wright. And a hat tip to Judith Heisey-Kabalik. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
So he shows up there, and then Brad walks through the door. And he's like flipping the F out.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
If I'm going to trip, I want to trip here, man. Walk in the woods, not my home.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
I don't dig him, and I don't dig the vibe he brings on set.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
He's a genius, you know. I mean, a once in every 50 or 100 years kind of genius.